Greetings, everybody, whatever time of day it is with you. I'm Nicholas Barr, Professor of Public Economics in the European Institute at LSE, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the launch of Philippe Le Grain's new book, Them and Us, How Immigrants and Locals Can Thrive Together, and to welcome our panel, Philippe himself and Heather Graby. A bit of housekeeping. For those of you who use Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is at hash LSE migration. The event's being recorded and will be made available as a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. There'll be the chance for you to submit your questions to the panel. To do that, please use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. Questions will be submitted to me, and I will put as many as possible to the speakers. And when you're doing that, please let us know your name and affiliation. Now, one of the many good things about teaching at LSE is to see the marvelous diversity of the things our former students and former colleagues go on to do. And Philippe is a wonderful example. He's hugely active in public discussion on matters related to Europe, broadly defined, and on wider issues such as immigration, and currently also on the economic fallout of the pandemic. And all those topics, he's a prolific author of books and topical articles in outlets such as Project Syndicate and CapEx. In previous lives, he's been advisor to the President of the European Commission, and prior to that, special advisor to the Director General of the World Trade Organization. At a more parochial level, it's terrific to have him still around the school as senior visiting fellow at the LSE European Institute, where he's spoken at events about Brexit and about refugees in Europe. And he's been on many panels about Brexit and the future of Europe. So it's terrific to have him present his new book at today's event. It's also great to have Heather Graby here. She's director of the Open Society European Policy Institute, which is the EU policy arm of the Open Society Foundation, which works to promote democratic pluralism and open society values. And as I read that, I gulp when I think about what's going on in the US election and keep my fingers tightly crossed. From 2004 to 2009, she was senior advisor to the then European Commissioner for Enlargement, Olli Rehn. And before that, she was deputy director of the Center for European Reform. And she's been an academic researcher at various universities and has taught at LSE. And directly relevant to this evening, she's worked on migration as an academic, in policy, and in an NGO. And she's done research on how migration is instrumentalized by populist politicians who often connect it spuriously to other issues. Now, Philippe's going to speak for 15 minutes or so, and Heather for about 10, and then we'll open up for Q&A. I'm going to mostly leave it to them to talk about the book, but I can't resist a couple of quick opening observations. People have often complimented me on the clarity of my writing, but in all the years, nobody's ever said that any of my books is a page turner. So I'm full of admiration for the way Philippe's book, like his others, is wonderfully clear and a page turner and academically rigorous with lots of endnotes with sources, including the most recent academic research. For me, one of the most important features of the book is that it doesn't limit itself to narrow economic dimensions, but also discusses cultural aspects and not just brief discussion, but extended discussion across five chapters. And one final point that particularly resonated with me. On page 162, the words that leapt out were diaspora networks foster trust. Now, in an odd way, I know all about that because one of the great diasporas is LSE alumni all over the world. And whenever I go, I bump into LSE alumni. I sat in the cafeteria at the World Bank and it almost felt as though I was back at LSE. And everywhere there is an implicit bond of trust between LSE alumni. And I think that for me is an illustration of exactly Philippe's point. So let me now, with great pleasure, hand over to Philippe. So Philippe, over to you.
Thank you so much, Nick. And thank you all for joining us. I need to get rid of the background in order to show you the book. Thank you so much for coming for the launch of Them and Us, How Immigrants and Locals Can Thrive Together. And a particularly big thank you also to Heather for contributing to tonight's discussion, and to Polly and the LSE's European Institute for hosting this event. Now, so much is going on right now, COVID, the US elections, Brexit. So why are we talking about immigration? It's not just because I have a new book out. It's also right at the center of all those issues. I mean, today's launch wouldn't have been possible without Zoom, a platform that was developed by a Chinese immigrant to the US. Our societies couldn't survive lockdowns without the essential workers, often immigrants, who pick and pack food, stack supermarket shelves, and deliver produce to our doors, who clean hospitals, and who care for the sick, like Jenny from New Zealand and Luis from Portugal, the two nurses who helped save Boris Johnson's life. And if we get a vaccine next year, it will be thanks to diverse teams of local and foreign scientists collaborating. Now, while the dividends generated by immigrants are huge, so too are the divisions. Many people locally blame them for everything that they feel is wrong with their life and with society. And far-right nationalists like Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, Viktor Orban, and Marine Le Pen capitalize on that. But that hostility is not set in stone. It looks like American voters have now rejected Donald Trump, though we'll wait to know for sure. And the situation in Britain and the rest of Europe is not as bleak as it sometimes seems. Now, my new book focuses on how immigrants and locals can thrive together in Europe, the US, and other Western societies. But I think it's important to situate the debate in a broader global context and in a smaller human one. So let me tell you about Bozi Kiekye, who was born in a poor farming village in war-torn Congo, which is the poorest country on earth. As a child, he helped his family scrape a living. And by tilling the land and trading his fruits, he managed to fund his studies and qualify as a teacher. But he was still desperately poor. The $150 a month that he took home wasn't enough to care for his wife and three kids. And then in 2009, he won the lottery, America's Diversity Visa Lottery, and with it, the right to move to the US. So he managed to borrow money, bought a flight, and left his family behind. In the US, his qualifications were useless, but he found a job as a janitor in an abattoir. It wasn't pleasant, but he earned much more than in Congo, $12.30 an hour. And he studied at night, and eventually he qualified again as a teacher. Then in 2016, he became a US citizen, and in 2018, he obtained visas for his family to come join him. Now, you may think it seems odd to select who can move to a country through a lottery. But life is a lottery. The biggest determinant of your life chances is not how talented you are, nor how hard you work. It's where you happen to have been born. And that's not just ethically wrong. It's economically wrong-headed. But migration can change that, because moving to a richer country opens up vastly greater opportunities for people like Bozi and his family, and they in turn contribute to the society that welcomes them. Sober economists reckon that abolishing all immigration controls could more than double the size of the world economy, and even slightly higher migration could generate absolutely huge gains. Because when people from poorer countries move to richer ones that are better governed, that have more machinery, computers, and other capital equipment, that make use of superior technologies, they become much more productive and earn much higher wages. Just look at football. Had Yaya Touré remained in Ivory Coast, he would have earned a pittance. Yet by moving to Manchester City, he was earning £240,000 a week. And just as Touré helped make Man City a better football team, so admitting immigrants benefits the societies that welcome them. And the key reason why immigration is so economically beneficial is precisely why it's so politically controversial. Migrants are different to locals. They have diverse attributes, skills, perspectives, and experiences that tend to complement local needs and circumstances, generating 8 big economic dividends. A diploma dividend, as international students like those here at the European Institute enrich their local peers' studies, pay higher fees, make more courses viable, help attract better professors, create jobs for local staff, and spend money locally. A deftness dividend, as many newcomers bring valuable scarce skills like medical training or fluency in Mandarin. And that in turn enhances the productivity and wages of their local colleagues. More than half of Switzerland's scientists, Australia's doctors, and America's computer science PhDs were born abroad. A diversity dividend, as newcomers' diverse experiences and perspectives help spark brilliant new ideas and technologies that improve all our lives. 1 in 3 Nobel laureates were born abroad. Diverse teams patent much more, are much more productive, and play much better football. Just look at the combination of Jordan Henderson and Mo Salah. A dynamism dividend, as newcomers are much, much more likely to start businesses that provide valuable products and services, create wealth, pay taxes, employ locals. Nearly half of the startups in Silicon Valley, of Britain's fastest growing companies, and of new German businesses were co-founded by immigrants. A drudgery dividend, as newcomers may be more willing to do dirty, difficult, and dull jobs at the local spurn, like pick fruit, clean offices, and care for children, freeing locals to do better paid, higher skilled jobs instead. A demographic dividend, as young, hardworking newcomers help pay for and care for the growing ranks of pensioners and support shrinking workforces and populations, and thus investment and growth. A debt dividend, as newcomers tend to pay more in taxes than they take out in services and benefits, subsidizing locals and spreading the huge government tax burden, the government debt burden over a wider tax base. And last and crucially, a development dividend, because migration doesn't just transform the life chances of people like Bozy and their children. The money that migrants send home dwarfs official aid. And when they return home, as many do, they often start businesses that transform local economies. And as also, as Nick mentioned, there are the benefits of diasporas. Now, those 8 economic dividends are huge. An IMF study finds that by adding additional young workers and increasing the diversity of skills and ideas, that each percentage point rise in the share of the migrant population tends to boost local living standards, GDP per capita, by 2%. Both high-skilled and less-skilled migration are beneficial, and crucially, the gains are shared between rich and poor locals. That means that people in the UK, Germany, and the US are some 30% richer thanks to migration, and that Canadians, New Zealanders, and Australians are much more so. Now, ethics and economics are powerful reasons to be open to migration. And immigrants also tend to enrich locals' lives socially and culturally. They broaden horizons, become friends and partners, stimulate new art, literature, and music, and provide, of course, a wider choice of ethnic restaurants. Yet many people oppose migration for social and cultural reasons. In particular, they worry about 4 I's: illegality, identity, illiberalism, and integration. They resent that some people cross borders without permission, including asylum seekers who are legally entitled to do so. They worry that diverse newcomers threaten national identity. They fear that illiberal migrants could undermine liberal societies, a desire that is explicit among jihadi terrorists and imputed among Muslims in general. And they fret that newcomers won't try to fit in. Now, some immigrants will continue to enter or remain in a country without permission until there are safe and legal channels for people to move, and until the status of settled undocumented migrants is regularized. Sadly, a few immigrants are criminals, or they're much less likely to be so than locals. And a tiny number are terrorists. And Islamist terrorists need to be dealt with as severely as far-right ones. But as the book documents at length, most immigrants, including much maligned Muslims, are legally resident, law-abiding, loyal to their adopted country, learning the local language, and aligning themselves with local ways. The bigger picture, though, is that no matter what immigrants do, how much they contribute, how much they try to fit in, they're often in the firing line, because they're on the front line of a much bigger culture clash between socially liberal internationalists and socially conservative nationalists. If you think about it, the debate about them is largely a debate about us. What kind of society do we want to live in? Now, in the short term, there are powerful forces pushing towards more closed nationalist societies. COVID mobility restrictions, rising unemployment, strained public services. And whether they're struggling economically or fearful of cultural change, many people feel they're losing status and want to take back control, even if it makes them poorer, and however illusory that control may be. But while things may get worse before they get better, there are also powerful trends pushing towards a greater openness and acceptance longer term. Foreign talent is in ever greater demand. Aging populations need care, prompting even Japan to open up. Younger people who grew up in diverse societies consider it normal. They have friends from all different backgrounds, and they probably don't even consider them different at all. Ever more people go to university, which tends to make people more liberal. While low-paid service workers also tend to be more positive about immigrants, perhaps because they tend to have more contact with them. Ever more voters are from an immigrant background, and most of them are in favor of openness. Mixed marriages and relationships are multiplying, and mixed race children proliferating. And attitudes towards immigration have improved as the consequences of the financial crisis have abated. And with luck, COVID will make locals appreciate much more the immigrants who provide essential services. If you look in nearly every Western country, a majority of young people favor more diversity. And younger, more educated locals are much, much, much keener on admitting more migrants from poorer countries than older, less educated locals. So time is on our side. And most people will also get used to and adapt to greater diversity. They'll get to know neighbors, meet colleagues, make friends, find the love of their life, who might just happen to originate somewhere else. And what was once frighteningly foreign will become reassuringly familiar. And eventually, we may even achieve Martin Luther King's vision of a society where people are judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. But to secure an open future, we need to do more to win over moderate skeptics. While we should not accept, let alone pander to racism and xenophobia, those who favor open, liberal, and progressive societies also need to engage with those who have different ideas of a good society, those who value order more than freedom, national identity more than individuality and global citizenship, and traditional communities more than chosen ones. They need reassurance that the future has space for them too. And it does. Canada, which has the highest immigration rate of any major economy, and also the citizens who are most enthusiastic about immigration, often has robustly conservative and socially conservative governments. And far from being a vision of super diverse hell, most people in London, conservative and liberal, tend to get along fine, polls show. We can also unite people around a more civic definition of national identity, a British dream defined by Mo Farah's feats, not Nigel Farage's fears, in which people can be proud of their country for different reasons and in different ways. At the same time, we need to robustly defend liberal values like the equality of men and women, the rule of law, and our democratic institutions against both Islamist and nationalist extremists. And we need to do more to make the most out of migration, whether it's communicating better, encouraging people to mix more, investing in depressed areas, and opening up opportunities to people of all backgrounds. Our diversity of both locals and migrants, women and men, gays and straights, could be a source of strength, not weakness, a reason to belong, not an excuse to exclude. We should embrace our diversity, and we should also celebrate what we have in common. The future is open. Let's make the best of it together.
Wow. Thank you very much. That see what I mean about page turner. So let me now turn over to Heather. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint those who are expecting a typically British ding-dong debate between a pro and an anti-person. The classic thing the BBC does is they phone you up and they say, so we've got a pro-European on, can you be the anti-European? We've got a pro-migration person on, can you be the anti-migration person? I am not that person, in contrast with Philippe, but what I can do is to discuss some really interesting aspects of this book, and particularly to link some of what Philippe has written about in this important and very helpful book to the political debates that are happening about migration in Europe today. So what I particularly like about Philippe's book is the way that he sets out the facts. Now, on the day when we can see how much of the US election campaign has been a fact-free zone, where in Britain, a cabinet minister was proud to say, we've had enough of experts, and where there's a regular decrying of data as being essential or evidence as being remotely relevant for policy debates, it's a bold move by Philippe Legrand to write a book which is packed full of data, evidence, very useful points that you can make in any discussion about migration. And the way that he combines data with very useful and interesting anecdotes and stories, really stories of the lived experience, both of real migrants, not the fantasies that you often hear about in the press and in political debate, but also the lived experience of people who haven't moved but have positive experiences of migration. And the way that he tells those stories and discusses what the implications are is really encouraging. And that's the kind of debate that we need to have about migration. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why it is that politics, the political debate about migration, is not following enough those kinds of data points and those stories about the real lived experience, and what books like Philippe's can do to help address that. So I think one absolutely key point to make is that migration is not just a policy issue. It's not just one policy issue amongst others. It has a massive psychological dimension that is frequently exploited in politics in a way that's very unhelpful to human beings living together in multicultural societies, and indeed in making good policy about migration itself. The political psychology of migration is absolutely key. And I very much like the way that Philippe, in one of his final chapters, Persuading Skeptics, he goes through, in fact, makes the case himself that facts are not enough, and talks about the fact that statistics, they can help, but there also need to be stories, and in particular, to think about the framing of refugees, the framing of particular kinds of migrants, which tend to dominate the whole debate and actually crowd out the important positive stories that he has himself told. So I just want to highlight the way that in the past few years, we've seen in the instrumentalization of migration for political purposes in ways that really does a disservice both to migrants and indeed to the whole communities which are diverse and multicultural and actually often doing well at it. So the instrumentalization is done often in a very negative way in order to drive wedges between communities. It's done with a very explicit political mission. And you can see this in the way that immigration is taken up as an issue by populist politicians in pretty well every part of the world. It's very hard to think of a pro-migration, pro-immigration populist politician. It's almost always used as a wedge issue. And increasingly, of course, those on the far right who've used this as an issue for a long time have written a playbook which is now taken up by centre-right politicians as well. I was encouraged this evening to see a tweet about Sebastian Kurz saying that the attacks in Vienna today should not be creating divisions in Austrian society, and it is not about Christians versus Muslims, it is about those who wish to live in peace and harmony in a multicultural society and those who wish to drive wedges. You could argue that he himself has driven a lot of those wedges in the past few years. So it's admirable that he's now stepping up and making that framing. But that framing matters a lot because of this instrumentalization. And the links in particular that have been frequently made by politicians in many countries between migration and terrorism are especially important. That's an immediate link that is very often made, and it's also in press coverage. There's often very irresponsible press coverage, looking first at the migration status of those involved in a terrorist attack, and only secondly about the motivations, and in particular the way that far-right politically driven terrorism is usually described as being done by a lone wolf and somebody who has mental illness, whereas those which are done wrongfully in the name of Islam are described as being ideologically or religiously driven. This is not borne out, but it's important to note the way that those links are made. There are, of course, also often in the UK debate, we've seen the way that the link has been made between migration and the European Union. And Philippe explains very well in the book the way that the Brexit campaign before the referendum in 2016, there were deliberate attempts to spread misinformation about migration and EU membership, particularly politicians who are actually in power arguing that the EU would force Britain to accept millions of Turks to come as immigrants, when in fact Turkey is very far away from EU membership and is not at the moment actively seeking it either. But that argument was made and emphasizing the fact that most Turks are Muslims as well. So these links were made, and you can see very much how in 2015 to 2016, there were all kinds of headlines which contained migration, terrorism, and EU. So there was a deliberate attempt to link these things together. Now, and I think what's very good about the book is the way that Philippe teases out these issues and explains where the real dividing lines are in society, and the fact that these links are often spuriously made. But of course, there are also important links about immigration that are not typically made in the political debate. And Philippe has also gone into those. So for example, the link between immigration and colonial legacies. It's no accident that the largest immigrant communities in France are from former French colonies, and in Britain from former British colonies. And yet this is often taken as a sort of an accident of history rather than the result of deliberate policies by those governments. Similarly, the Netherlands immigration from former Dutch colonies in previous centuries. Another link that's often not made is economic pull factors, that actually it's not saving lives at sea that encourages people to migrate. It's actually labor market needs. And those labor market needs actually need to be met through legal migration schemes rather than by encouraging workers in the black economy, where they're very often exploited as well. And of course, there's a very tricky issue of the link with climate. And my worry is that this will become a new wedge issue, that the fears that will now be stoked by populist politicians who are moving away from climate denial as they can no longer deny the evidence we see before our eyes that climate change is actually happening. And instead, they will simply try and link it again to migration and claim that climate will cause new hordes and tidal waves and other metaphors of migrants arriving in Europe in order to drive wedges. There's a real risk, I think, that the same kinds of tactics can be used there. So how can these kinds of arguments be countered? Well, how can these spurious linkages be countered? Well, Philippe provides a lot of examples in his book, and I really encourage you to give a copy to everybody you meet who starts making them. It's a perfect thing for your next book club. It's the perfect gift for Christmas. It's been released exactly in the right time, so I give it a good plug there. And of course, COVID has given an additional push to many of his arguments. And fortunately, the book went to press after the pandemic began, and so Philippe was able to include some interesting examples. But I would just point out a couple more which have become even more evident since the book went to press. One of them is how so many of the vital, essential workers in our economies are in fact migrants, and often in sectors which have been considered are talked about as low-skilled, but really those definitions need revision, because the seemingly low-skilled jobs in the NHS, for example, are the ones that are saving people's lives. It's really essential that you've got all of the support workers in hospitals to man the ICU units. This isn't just the highly skilled migrants like doctors, who, by the way, have been disproportionately affected, of course, by COVID in the UK, but it's also all of the technicians and the cleaners and the others who keep the hospitals going day and night. Essential workers are also, of course, those who are providing postal services, those who are doing all of the delivery jobs that are keeping people fed and in a reasonable level of comfort during lockdown. It's also all of the people who have been helping with agriculture. And here I'd just like to stress the way that one of the key things the pandemic has shown is the massive dependency of all European economies on migrant labourers in agriculture, who are an essential part of the food supply chain. And in fact, it busted a lot of the myths about migration when governments who had said, and politicians who'd said, well, look, we don't need migrant workers, suddenly discovered that actually locals really couldn't do this job when migrant workers couldn't travel across Europe to do those jobs. It also showed, and the reason why locals couldn't do those jobs was not only because they were unwilling to do so, but also they lacked the skills. Picking asparagus actually takes some skill. I've tried it, and it's not something you just learn overnight, and you have to be in a very high level of physical fitness. Similarly, pruning olive trees, you need to know what you're doing. These are not simply supply of labor that can come from anywhere. And in fact, the migrant workers whom the whole agricultural and food supply chain depend on are often in some of the most precarious conditions and exploited because of the black holes of lack of accountability and supply chains, and that's also been shown up by the pandemic. So the need to have a much more holistic approach to labour migration, particularly across the whole of Europe, has been brought into sharp relief by this series of lockdowns, and I hope it will lead to a different kind of debate. It's also very important to recognise the research in political psychology, and this is my last point, about the responsibility of politicians in how they talk about migration. There was some very interesting work done at Oxford University, if I may mention another academic institution, by some political psychologists who looked at how people's attitudes towards migration and understanding of the policy trade-offs and dilemmas is affected by the framing. So they could be told the same phrase, in fact, a false phrase about migration, and put in the mouth of Nigel Farage, of David
You've broken up, Heather. Let us give Heather a few more seconds.
Okay.
Heather, we lost you for a while.
Okay. Let me just finish up with a couple. Do you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just going to give you, I'm just going to finish with a point about the responsibility of politicians, because the psychological framing is so important when it comes to migration. They have a responsibility because the signals from political leaders very much affect people's attitudes, and they affect the lived experience of migrants and whether they integrate well into a society and whether that society benefits from the skills and perspectives that they bring. It's really important to recognize that having hysterical political debate about asylum in particular makes the integration of migrants, and that includes legal migrants, and the vast majority, of course, do arrive legally. The vast majority of immigrants in Europe and in the UK as well arrive via legal routes through family reunification. They don't arrive, in fact, on boats. That's a really small number of people. But this overwhelming focus of the political debate around a hysteria about asylum means that it's much harder to achieve a well-functioning multicultural society. So it actually creates a hostile environment, and it promotes racism because it increases fear and it drives up the sense of them and us rather than all of us. So I very much hope that the better angels of our nature, as Abraham Lincoln called it, are something that politicians can draw on rather more, and to consider the responsibility that they have to ensure that the migrants who've made such amazing contributions to our societies, our economies, our culture as well, are recognised and celebrated rather than being instrumentalised for political purposes alone. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Heather. Thank you very much, both of you. Let me now encourage people in the audience to send in questions via the Q&A. We'll try and answer as many as possible. Please include your name and affiliation. And I'm aiming to leave a few minutes at the end so that Philippe and Heather, if they have any final thoughts, can let us have those. So let me start off with, this is from Martin Westlake, visiting professor at the European Institute and College of Europe in Bruges. And I'm just going to read it out verbatim because it reads very well. Warmest congratulations, dear Philippe, for a great book, which makes excellent economic sense, but is also full of moral force. And as Heza said, is a bold, brave even analysis. You write convincingly about Europe's aging population and the demographic dividend. From that point of view, immigration isn't an optional extra, but a necessity. And yet immigration is all too often a dirty word in political discourses. Again, Heather has pointed out with regard to the quote unquote threat of Turkish accession. So my question to you is, how can the venom be drawn and a more sophisticated debate be launched? In particular, how can we introduce a more nuanced vocabulary in democratic politics that distinguishes between candidates for asylum, genuine and recognized refugees, displaced people, economic migrants, and so on? After all, more often than not, the politicians who take to our airwaves are descendants of immigrants. So in a way, that's the $64,000 question, you know, how can you get people to think sensibly about these things? Philippe.
Well, I think politicians are human they respond, I'll say this in economists, they respond to incentives. And I think obviously the victory in 2016 of Donald Trump and the victory of the Brexit vote on the back of whipping up anti-immigrant hysteria, even though not all Brexiteers are anti-immigration, basically broke taboos and made it seem advantageous to opportunistic politicians to up the anti-immigrant rhetoric, and there've been lots of people who've been mini Trumps or temporarily acted as mini Trumps. And if I want to be optimistic, I'll say hopefully the defeat Donald Trump, though not by a landslide, but still in popular vote, a convincing defeat, can prompt a reevaluation of whether actually it is in narrowly in politicians' interests to be pursuing what Heather rightly calls a wedge strategy. I think that a more persuasive argument, perhaps in European political systems, which aren't tend to be winner takes all, but more based on coalitions, is that pandering to or echoing the far right doesn't tend to work as a political strategy. At the end of the day, if you echo the lines and the policies of the far right, you give them publicity, you give them legitimacy, and you then tend to encourage people to vote for the real thing. And you can't win in a war kind of raising the stakes with the far right, because the far right are always going to be able to propose something more outrageous than you can. And if you've made that seem legitimate and open and acceptable, then you don't just compromise yourself morally and ethically, and most people do have a moral conscience, but you also, in most cases, don't end up winning the political prize that you hope for. And I think there is, on both the center right and on the center left, a temptation to pander to the far right, because many social conservative voters are from the traditional working classes, which the center left thinks are their traditional voting pool. And many social conservatives, the center right think naturally belong with them. And therefore there can be a kind of bidding war in which nobody wins, and actually you end up the far right as the winner and society as a loser. I think that dynamic can be broken. I think Emmanuel Macron, by confronting Marine Le Pen last presidential election in France, showed that you could win by confronting it, though he's been perhaps less forthright in defending open society since he's been in power than beforehand. Longer term, I think I have to point to the many positive trends that I mentioned in my initial remarks. The voter pool is changing, and the young, more educated voters of the future who are repelled by anti-immigrant rhetoric. And if you lose them, ultimately you will carry on losing elections.
So you're saying it's a cohort effect, not an age effect. The young aren't going to turn into grumpy old people.
There is an argument. Eric Kaufman has written a book where he argues actually quite potentially that young people will become more conservative as they age. And while that may be true economically, we haven't seen baby boomers become more socially conservative.
Yeah. Okay. You want to pitch in a question?
I don't think it will.
Just a quick additional point, which is the venom is there because it's easy to drive a wedge, because migrants are a group who can be referred to in a way that almost nobody else can. They can be referred to as foreigners, as different as them, rather than us. And that you can't get away from that that factor. But that's why I think it's really vital to point out, as Philippe does, how this vital contribution that migration in general makes to societies, and that the economic and cultural benefits of migration that outweigh disadvantages, which are very frequently raised, and also the need for good policies. The fact that migration itself and migrants as people get blamed for things like shortages of hospital beds and shortages of places in schools, when actually that's the fault of the public services, who should be planning for this. Think about how, for example, in the UK, the Treasury initially proposed additional funding to local authorities who were receiving a large number of East European immigrants after the 2004 enlargement. And then this got cancelled as a budget-saving measure. That could have made made a huge difference to the way that the million Poles who arrived in the UK were received and perceived, if that additional funding to those local authorities had actually gone ahead. So there are some real policy issues here that need to be addressed, as well as continuing to make this case that look at the benefits, look at the way this is happening, and also humanizing the migrants. That's why these stories are so important, because people, it's amazing how many people will say, well, yeah, of course, I like, you know, X footballer or Y Olympic athlete who serves my country, even though that person is foreign born. But it's those ones that I've heard about, that my newspaper told me about, that some demagogue told me about. That's the lump. That's the sort of the other, the faceless other. And so it's by humanizing that you can remove some of those myths.
Thank you. Let me turn now to a question from Linda in Edinburgh, who says, the Scottish government wants to take a different approach to immigration than the UK government. What do you think are the chances of the UK government giving the Scottish government immigration powers while still part of the UK?
Well, I think, thank you, Linda. I think that there are sort of two parts of that question. But first of all, whether it's desirable and whether it's feasible. I mean, there are lots of countries that operate regional visa programs, such as Canada, Australia, and so on. And there is nothing to prevent a nation state either devolving responsibility for migration down to a regional level, whereby regional governments set quotas or set rules individually, or for the federal government or national government to explicitly include that in its own rules. So in principle, it's perfectly, it's supposed to be feasible practically. And given that the Scottish people have in general, and the Scottish government in particular, have a much more positive attitude towards migration than the government in London. Scotland faces greater demographic issues, a declining population, and a political class that is much, much more open to immigration. Then it would seem to me a good idea to allow the Scottish government or for the UK government to create Scotland only visas, and I think there's technically no issue to it. Whether the government in London will do so, I think that's unlikely. Taking back control for the Brexiteers, which during the referendum they said about was taking back control to give back control back to the people, actually has in practice meant taking back control to give more power to ministers in Whitehall, and they're very jealous of those powers. And Priti Patel seems adamant that she knows best how to micromanage the employment and other needs of the entire UK economy. And she seems intent on slamming the door on people like her parents, who fortunately were allowed into this country and who enabled her to grow up here and to prosper her here. And I think that's deeply regrettable. So to cut long story short, it would be a perfectly good idea, but I don't think it's going to happen short of Scottish independence.
Heather, anything you want to add? Okay, let me now turn. This is from my colleague in the economics department at LSE, Alan Manning, former chair of the Migration Advisory Committee. And he says, when I was chair of the Migration Advisory Committee, I read the studies you refer to, but there are others you don't refer to that have a little less rosy view of the gains from migration for residents of destination countries. Do you worry that presenting selective evidence for an overly simplistic narrative that is comforting to the typical progressive reader without challenging any of their preconceptions actually undermines the case you have for a more open migration system, because it underestimates the difficult trade-offs involved in migration policy and so ends up with a limited traction outside a rather small group? In other words, he's saying, are you rallying the faithful rather than converting the skeptics?
Well, with all due respect to Alan Manning, who I've met and discussed with this before, he is a labor economist. And like labor economists, he's like the hammer who only thinks everything is a nail. And he only in his studies looks at the short-term comparative static labor market effects of migration, which is basically missing the point. When you have nearly half of the fastest growing companies in Britain set up by migrants, if you exclude the impact of entrepreneurship from your studies of the impact of migration, you're missing the point. If you have perhaps the eminent global city that London is, and you exclude the impact of diversity in terms of innovation, in terms of process and product innovation, because it's outside the purview of your narrow models and you can't compute it with your narrow models, then who is being simplistic? I mean, I, with all due respect to Alan Manning, you know, he's perhaps a very good labor economist, but his view of migration is narrowly simplistic and completely and utterly misses the point. Because in a comparative static world, nothing much happens. And actually we live in a dynamic world, and we live a world of uncertainty, and we live in a world where, you know, the big X factor is innovation and enterprise, and where migrants, and crucially, not just migrants individually, but migrants working together with locals, the diversity of that is an absolutely crucial impact. And if you just abstract it away, as Alan Manning's studies does, then basically you are completely and utterly missing the point. And actually you are misleading ministers. And even with your expertise, you are misleading the wider public. Now, my book is actually brutally honest about, you know, the downsides, perceived and real, of migration. I address full head on, and as I did in my remarks today, the most difficult issues, like the ones surrounding terrorism. What I challenge you, Alan Manning, to do is actually to have the breadth to read more broadly and to look beyond your narrow models and to actually look at the breadth of evidence that is not just in my book, but elsewhere, about the contribution that migrants make, to read a bit of history, to read a bit of culture, to read a bit about the history of science, to look into you know, the study of diversity at Santa Fe Institute, basically to take your blinkers off. And perhaps it's very hard because, you know, professional economists, for good or ill, have very, very narrow specialism. It's the world that we live in. You know, you might be very, very good at manipulating your little models, but your little models are actually misleading and missing the point.
LSE lives and breathes on controversy, and I think we've just heard the opening trail for what ought to be a separate public debate between Philippe and Alan, because whilst I agree that too narrow an interpretation of economic models is problematic, it would be interesting to have time to unpack these arguments. Heather.
Yeah, I'll just add a small point of view from a political scientist. Alan, I think, makes an important point about often there are difficult trade-offs in migration policy. And I think the big problem that we have is how little migration policy, the actual intricate details of how to manage the consequences of migration well, these get lost because of the hysteria around the small number of asylum seekers and the absolutely tiny number of migrants who commit criminal offences or terrorist acts and so on. There's so much hype around this that it's actually very difficult to discuss, for example, what integration measures work best, which are more effective and which are less effective, which cities have done better in managing the challenges of multiculturalism and indeed pressure for different kinds of resources. Issues like the issue that Alan points to about the impact on residents of destination countries in the short term, because there can be short-term detrimental effects on them. That's the job of government to address. They should be looking at transition funds for affected communities. There's no doubt that the people of Lesbos and the people of Lampedusa have been extremely ill-served by their governments, who have not put in place the right kinds of policy measures to help them to deal with a crisis situation, for example. So I think there's an important set of, there are many issues to do with migration policy that are actually very rarely debated in public and are mostly debated among experts because of the domination of the public debate by the wedge issues.
And let me just add, I mean, even on, you know, the narrow models that Alan Manning deploys, you know, the studies done by the Migration Advisory Committee have shown very clearly that there is, even with their narrow models, which exclude the broader dynamic gains, that there is little or no impact on locals' wages, that there is little or no impact on migrants' employment, that it doesn't have a detrimental impact on training, or indeed all the other catalogue of things that politicians of the likes of Nigel Farage and others make. So even in the narrow bailiwick in which Alan Manning specialises, and even in you know, when commissioned by an anti-migration government to produce evidence to justify the prejudices of the likes of, at the time, Theresa May, you know, the likes of Alan Manning wasn't able to find that. Now, he would probably say, but actually, you know, the benefits aren't that large. And that's why I'm pointing, actually, the benefits are large. And if you think that those benefits actually benefit everyone, whether it's through the taxes, whether it's through the employment, whether it's through the new products and services, then actually, even if you accept the Alan Manning view of the world, all those complementary benefits actually mean that it's overwhelmingly positive for people.
Let us now move to a question by Alan Riding, who's a writer in France, which, as we all know, has recently been struck by two dreadful acts of Islamist terrorism, one carried out by the son of refugees, the other by an illegal immigrant. Question is, how can any government combat such terrorism without the population at large associating it with Muslim immigration? And let me just add, I was reading an article that said amongst the heroes who sort of rescued a badly injured policeman, etc., were indeed two Muslim immigrants. So it's how do you get out that side of the story rather than the negative the negative attitudes towards Muslim immigration?
Well, I mean, terrorism is evil, and when it is perpetrated, whether it's perpetrated by people who are born in a country or perpetrated by people who are born elsewhere, it is evil. Whether it is perpetrated by the people who are descended from people who've been in the country for generations, or the children of immigrants, it's evil. There's no two ways about it. At the same time, most immigrants aren't Muslims, most Muslims aren't extremists, and most extremists aren't terrorists. I grew up with, and most people in Britain did, with experience of a very different kind of terrorism, which was IRA terrorism. It was part of the furniture of growing up. And during that period of the long IRA bombing campaign, the border between the UK and Ireland remained entirely open. You could travel from one to the other without having to show your passport. And no one conflated Irishness with terrorism, or suggested that just because a tiny minority were blowing people up, that you should stop people in general from that ethnic group coming into the country. Now, clearly, there is a very severe problem. There's a severe problem also with far-right terrorism. Indeed, over the past decade in Europe and indeed in the US, there have been more deaths from far-right terrorism than there have been from Islamist terrorism. It doesn't excuse the Islamist terrorism, but it puts it in context. And to a certain extent, they feed off each other. I mean, you know, they are the evil twins. They both hate open liberal societies. And they both are a threat to it. I think that while we need to be very, very tough in tackling terrorism, we also need to be proportionate in what we do to combat it. We also need to not tar all people with the same brush. I mean, you know, if you have someone who is a religious extremist who blows people up and they happen to be a Christian, we don't say that that implicates all Christians. If someone who's a religious extremist enacts in the name of Islam, nor does that tar, should that tar all Muslims with the same brush. And I think actually there is a very real problem in our society, whether it is expressed violently or not, about people who reject the liberal values on which our societies are based. I think the bigger threat, you know, politically, comes from the far right, because, you know, they've actually been winning elections like Donald Trump in 2016. But it is equally, in terms of violence, very serious on the Islamist side. And my book is brutally honest that this is unacceptable and dangerous, at the same time as putting it in context, and at the same time as urging proportionate effective measures, not the blanket scapegoating of immigrants in general or Muslims in general.
Heather.
Yes, I essentially agree. I mentioned earlier the tendency in the press to stress Muslim connections in some terrorist attacks, but then not to talk about far-right white supremacist ideology as a factor in other terrorist attacks. Think about Oklahoma City, for example. And certainly I think we could refer to, you know, the appalling murder of Joe Cox. The murderer was not a representative of the people of Batley or of the views of most white men of his age. So I think we need to think of it in that way. The tragedy is that when political leaders don't make a very clear distinction between the views of the vast majority of Muslims in their country and the views of a terrorist, this just makes the situation much worse for everybody in that country, because it's an area where very, very good political leadership is needed. And you can see very clearly the mettle of a political leader by how they respond in that kind of moment. I was particularly impressed by the way that Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand terrorist attacks in Christchurch, for example.
Yep. Let us keep moving. We want to get in as many questions as possible. This is a question from Elisa Crescenzo, who's an A-level student in London. And it's addressed to either speaker. Would you say there is a large distinction between migrants who are of color and those who are ethnically white, and that they suffer from different forms of discrimination from the media and government?
I think this is a really interesting question. And it's a really important one that actually needs more empirical work done on it as well, to look at the kinds of discrimination and the lived experience that people go through. I would just observe from the UK experience what happened when the Polish migrants arrived after the 2004 enlargement. And I remember sitting in policy discussions in Whitehall with British officials who said, oh, we don't think that the new member states of the EU from Central Eastern Europe, that migration is going to be at all controversial, because, you know, they're Christians, they're white, they'll fit in straight away. It's just a matter of how fast they learn English. So we don't really need to prepare the public for what might happen there. And it's interesting how the Polish plumber, it wasn't the Catholicism of the Poles who came to Britain or their skin colour, which was referred to. It was their profession and the age-old argument about undercutting wages and taking away jobs and taking away benefits at the same time and so on that were rolled out about it. So, yes, it's still possible to discriminate. Unfortunately, there are plenty of attested cases of, there was even a murder in one part of London of a Polish worker. So yes, definitely there's always going to be discrimination of one kind or another, but it's important to look at how that manifests itself. And again, political leadership really matters.
Well, I think I agree with Heather. Like, I think beforehand, not just politicians, but other commentators thought that because these Europeans were white, Christian and European, that their arrival would be much less problematic. And certainly one has seen across most of the EU that by and large, migration within the EU has not been controversial, and that when far-right populists have attempted to attack East European migrants, largely they fall on deaf ears. So Geert Wilders in the Netherlands tried it for a while, and then he went back to bashing Muslims because it didn't work as well. So Britain is perhaps an outlier in that respect. I think in terms of the broader question, I think it's pretty likely, though again, I think more research is needed, I'm pretty likely that non-white migrants face a tougher time than white ones do, because obviously they face racial discrimination, or they may face racial discrimination, which the non-white ones don't, and their children and grandchildren are less visibly of an immigrant background, and therefore one hopes less subject to discrimination than those who are non-white. So for example, you know, Dominic Raab, you could forget that he's the son of an immigrant, or likewise, you might forget that Boris Johnson has Turkish ancestry. That's much harder, obviously, otherwise. So I think it's pretty much harder if you're non-white than if you're white.
I mean, as an approximate shorthand, is it the case that white immigrants, if they do suffer from discrimination, it's more likely to be for economic reasons, like they're taking our jobs, rather than for anything else?
You know, in fact, Heather referred to the fear of the other, and I tend to refer to xenophobia. I think obviously xenophobia can map onto racism, and obviously racism can be deployed towards British people as well as to foreigners, or to locals as well as to immigrants. I think that you can express cultural xenophobia, like in they don't speak our language, even if the skin color is the same. So I don't think it's not just about it's not just about economics. It can be cultural too. And if you certainly look at, you know, people who are interviewed in Boston in Lincolnshire, which was the place with the highest Eastern European migration in the UK and the highest leave vote, you saw many anti-immigrant views, which were expressed not just in economic terms, but also in cultural ones. Although in either case with those two, you've got to be careful, because, you know, some people express economic gripes in cultural terms, and some people likewise cultural gripes in economic terms, and it's not always clear what the root cause is and how they interact.
Yeah, okay. Right, this is now a question from Astrid, who is an LSE alumna from Italy. Thank you for this enlightening debate. Italy is one of the first destinations for migrants and refugees. And now, sadly, sentiments seem to be arising in the face of economic consequences of the COVID crisis, which are more and more anti-immigrant and hugely exploited by politicians such as Mr. Salvini. My question is, do you see only long-term solutions to this unwelcoming atmosphere, now worsened by a sort of quote-unquote war among the poor? So can anything be done?
I think that's a very interesting point here about this war among the poor that Astrid makes, because one of the classic political plays that populists like Salvini make is to essentially put as a proposition to the less well-off in a society that they still have something to lose by those who are poorer than them. So basically to drive a wedge between poor communities by telling, for example, the white working class that your job is threatened. And I had a very good quotation in Spanish. I'll quote it in English, but it was from a Spanish politician who said, what I need to do to persuade my voters to continue believing that migration is good for Spain is that actually it's the rich white guy who is a threat to their job, not the poor brown guy. So this point that what Salvini and others have done is to suggest that to people who have been disadvantaged in a society, who aren't well off, who've been left behind by globalization, who've maybe really had experienced difficulties in their lives, that the fault is not of a political system that has not served them well, and by a series of governments which have not, for example, introduced labor market reforms, which would give their chances of would raise their chances of employment, that instead they should blame the newly arrived person or the person who seems different from them. And so that's the problem, that's exactly the kind of wedge technique that is being used so much. And the tragedy is that Italy, which is of course was for nearly a century a country of emigration, and Philippe points this out in his book, it's Italy and Spain have both had for a very long time a quite welcoming culture on migration. Of course, there's racism in every country. Of course, there are problems. But on the whole, it was a much more welcoming culture for migrants than many others in Europe. And yet populism has now arrived on the scene in Salvini in Italy. Well, it happened in Italy earlier, but now with Vox in Spain, it's arriving in Spain as well. Interesting to see the way that Ireland, again, historically a country of immigration has become more controversial over time as well. So that the issue is always ripe for exploitation. The question is, how can you talk to people about the economic factors that are affecting their livelihoods and the outlook for them and for their families in terms that takes it away from a blame game of one group of people against another?
Well, I mean, politicians, and it's a big ask, politicians need to be honest with people, which is that Europe is a rich, aging continent, and Africa is a young, poor one, often with war and civil unrest, and that Africans are going to carry on trying to get to Europe. And so the question is, to what extent do we want Africans to come legally and safely, and then to work to do the jobs that need doing, not least in a place like Italy, to care for the elderly? Or to what extent do we want to try and stop people coming, to create a humanitarian crisis, create a political crisis, drive immigration into the shadows, lock people up in camps rather than allowing them to work, thereby imposing cost on the public purse, where people could instead be working and paying taxes. I think that is a political a choice. And to be fair, the likes of Matteo Salvini has chosen one course of action, and different Italian governments could choose a different one. In terms of the broader issue about how you change the political debate, it's not just about the long-term trends that I pointed to. It's also about some of the things that Heather referred to about using stories as well as facts, about using compelling narratives, about encouraging people to mix and social contact, which is one of the most powerful ways of overcoming prejudice, about changes in government policy, for example, allowing one, processing asylum claims faster, and two, allowing asylum seekers to work as soon as possible, both of which seem to have big benefits, not just for asylum seekers themselves, but also for the labour market as a public purse. And last but not least, changes in politics. And Emmanuel Macron shows that you can win by turning the tables on the populace. It would be great if there was a similar message be putting across by a popular Italian politician.
So much of this goes back to political leadership. I mean, thinking of New Zealand, for instance, where, having strong political leadership made a huge difference. Let me move on. We've got time for one more question, certainly. This is from Marina Kaneko of the Japan Local Government Center, who asks, do you think that the class system in the UK affects perspective on immigrants? I moved to London recently, she writes, but I sometimes feel the people are divided, not only immigrants or not, but also occupations or classes. So I guess it's the intersection of social class and attitudes towards immigration. There's a nice small question for you.
I can start on this one. I'm sure Philippe will have a lot more to say. Yes, of course. And Britain is still a more class divided country than many others in Europe. And yes, it's a huge issue. One of the interesting changes in the politics of immigration in Britain over the past 20 years is the way that parts of the political left who drew their support from working class communities, and which had always voted Labour and which were strongly unionised, moved from being much more pro-migration to being much more anti-immigration. So, and the Conservative Party picked up their votes at the last election by running a quite strongly anti-immigration platform. So think about the way that, for example, the Trades Unions Congress in the 1990s was very much in favor of ensuring that migrants were legal, that there should be, you know, more opportunities for legal migration, because then those new workers in the British labour force could become unionised, but also because it prevented undercutting of wages with black market workers and indeed exploitation of those workers. And they moved into a much more, a number of unions moved into a much more anti-migrant worker stance in the second half in the last 5 years or so. So it's really striking how much things have changed. And the way that you saw the way that the Labour Party itself moved from looking at worker solidarity, including with migrant workers, to British jobs for British workers as a slogan that Gordon Brown put forward as an electoral slogan as Prime Minister. So I think this question of class divide is one that has very much played into the politics of migration in Britain. And unfortunately, it's one where, again, the pitting of workers against workers and the idea that it's all about the colour of your skin rather than about the structural injustices that are there in British society. This does a real injustice to the interests of all of the classes.
I think obviously that Britain is riven by class as well as by other divides, and that the clearest expression of that in the migration debate, as Heather referred to in her initial remarks, is the routine denigration of certain types of a worker and certain types of migrant as unskilled and therefore sort of useless, by extension, you know, a burden, when in fact the work that they do is essential and difficult. And just because it happens to be low paid, at least in Britain, or just because, at least in Britain, it doesn't have to require a formal qualification, that therefore it is dismissed and denigrated. Now, it doesn't have to be the case. You know, for example, in different labour market systems, such as Sweden, many jobs that we consider low skilled require qualifications and are higher paid and have higher social status. And indeed, many traditional working class jobs used to have higher status than they do now. So there's nothing set in stone about that. And certainly one hopes that if there is a silver lining to this terrible coronavirus pandemic, that it can change the perception of people doing essential work, whether they are born locally or abroad, and actually raise their social status, which incidentally would have a positive political impact, because to a certain extent, the backlash against immigration and against establishment in general is not just about a feeling about being hard done by. It's also about a feeling of being denigrated, of being treated of little worth. And that in turn leads to the denigration of migration, so of migrants. And therefore, actually, if you can change that dynamic and actually pay better, offer better employment conditions, and increase the status of people doing essential work, and then that would have perhaps create a virtuous circle.
Thank you. Right, let us now return to our two panelists, and for any final thoughts you have. And I think, Heather, if we come to you first, and then we'll let Philippe have the final word.
Sure, thank you. Well, thanks for all these interesting questions, many of which are imponderables as well. I think the fundamental thing to bear in mind is migration is in itself neither good nor bad, in my view. I know Philippe has a view that it is definitely good. It's a fact of life. It's something that has always happened. We are all ultimately the descendants of migrants because human beings came from Africa, evolved in Africa, came from Africa, moved to Europe. And there are very few of us who do not have in our genetic makeup strains and very, I'm sure, very useful talents and genetic tendencies which come from elsewhere than the place where we were born. So that's that fact of life, and that it's normal for humans to move around, and that the idea that there are indigenous people and that there are newcomers is something which is typically of very recent coinage. It's typically the case that the newcomers of one generation are then become the indigenous people of the next generation. I think the historical perspective and the fact that migration has always been there and will always be there is key. It's also very important to realize that the forced migration that happens because of wars, because of climate emergencies and climate-linked crises that force people to move from their homes, that's something that has always happened. And in fact, the vast majority of people who move are in fact internally displaced people. They're forced to move from their homes to somewhere else in their own country or in their own region. And it's actually a very small number that come into Europe from outside Europe. It's much more intra-regional migration that actually happens. Some of these very basic facts about migration globally and historically need to be told more often to bust the myth that it's about us and them, and that somehow building a wall either between the US and Mexico or across the English Channel or across the Mediterranean is going to solve the problems of inequality, of economic stagnation, of climate change and its impact on people, it's really, really important to keep countering this, particularly because I think that COVID is the first of a number of emergencies that we're going to face, because climate change is already bringing major changes that will force people to move more, including many of us at this seminar tonight. Many of us will find that at some point in the next 50 years, we will need to move because of some climate-induced change. Now, that might be because of insect-borne diseases. COVID could just be the first of many pandemics because of rising temperatures and biodiversity loss, which of course contributed to COVID itself jumping the species barrier. Climate will also cause other kinds of problems, water shortages, droughts, and also, of course, floods, conversely, in other areas. So, plus rising sea levels and so on. And so we need to have a better informed and much better managed migration policy debate, which is about the real issues at stake rather than the myths, in order to confront the challenges that are going to face us in the next decades.
Oh, you mean you're saying you should let some rationality and evidence come into it?
Far be it from me to say that experts have a role in public policy. Yeah. We know that's no longer the case in the United Kingdom, but I still have hope it might be elsewhere.
It's a beguiling vision, isn't it? Philippe, the last word to you.
Well, first of all, thank you to everyone who's listened in when there's a nail-biting US election going on in the background, and everyone's probably checking their phones every 2 minutes. And thank you to Nick and to Heather for a great discussion. I think my final word is that freedom of movement is a fundamentally important freedom. And one of the saddest aspects of the Brexit debate is the way that the ending of freedom of movement was somehow portrayed as something fantastic, because the emphasis was all on denying people the opportunity to move to Britain, when what is being lost by British people who don't aren't fortunate enough to have an EU passport is the freedom to move for any reason across 27 other countries to study, to work, to explore a different country, to be with the person you love. And that is a fundamentally important freedom that is denied to most people in the world. And perhaps actually, as a result of this sadness, there'll be a greater awareness in Britain a bit what it's like to be born in a country, in a poorer country, where you don't have that freedom to leave, where people might say, I don't like what's happening to my country, and they're not able to move. And that is very, very sad if you're British, and it's very, very sad if you're from another country. So I think, I hope that we will move eventually to a world where people, everyone can move freely, not just within Europe, but globally, where freedom is no longer the privilege of the people who happen to have high skills, who happen to have wealth, but like in the European Union, something which is the right of everybody. And I think such a world would be a much better world. In the short term, we need to fight back against those people who want to close us off and divide us and to demonize others for the problems that they've created. And hopefully the defeat of Donald Trump is the start of a fight back against anti-immigration populists and people who want to deny us freedom.
Well, let me wind up, first of all, by thanking you all in the audience for taking part, and thank you for some terrific questions. It's been a huge pleasure to chair this, partly because the topic's so important, partly at a personal level because I've known Philippe since his student days and have watched with great pleasure as his writing and his career has gone stratospheric. It's also been lovely to have Heather sort of as part of this group discussion. I hope this will carry on. I hope the book is a howling bestseller. I hope it will generate good debate about immigration rather than emotional rants, which really don't help. So let me end by thanking you both and thanking you, the audience, and have a good evening, all of you, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for the US election. Good night, everybody.